The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
I'm ready to sell Ginzu knives at the fair now. Hi, everybody. My name is Doug Miguel. I run a meditation center in Rochester, Minnesota. Many of you are friends, and others I've not met yet, but just want to introduce myself. I've been coming to Common Ground for 6 years, 7 years, something like that. Yeah, I started in 2004 and have always considered this to be home base, the mothership. And so I'm really delighted to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation to come up and give this Dharma talk and to sit with you. So the theme of tonight's talk is the Buddha's last word. And I picked that title and that theme because I just finished teaching an 8-week course on mindfulness with breathing with a former monk who was well known to people at Common Ground named Santi Caro. He was a monk in the Thai forest tradition for about 20 years and returned maybe 6 or 7 years ago. He's running a retreat center in Wisconsin, and he specializes in, and got to know through his teacher, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, this particular meditation technique called Anapanasati, mindfulness with breathing. And we did an 8-week course, and I gave the last Dharma talk in the course. I was alternating with Santi Caro, and I was trying to think of a theme to kind of wrap things up. And I recalled that the Buddha gave a very short, pithy instruction at the very end of his life, the very last words he spoke. And I thought that one specific pithy instruction at the end really gave a kind of shape to his entire life, and it gave a kind of shape to all of his meditation instructions as well. And it helped me to understand Anapanasati. And so I used the theme in my Thursday night talk in Rochester, and I'm repeating it here tonight. I want to start by telling a little story. Some of you may have heard it, about Pope John the 23rd, who was a pope who really changed a lot of the Catholic liturgy. And he tells this story about really fretting and worrying about all the changes that he was instituting. And, waking up at night and sort of being dreamy and sleepy and worried and in that sort of half-dreamy state saying to himself, you know, I really need to talk to the Pope about this. And then when he woke up, he'd go, wait a minute, I am the Pope. And the reason I'm starting with that little humorous story is because there's a quality in there that's very apropos, I think, to each of us as we reach the kind of critical moment in our own meditating lives and in our own spiritual lives when we say to ourselves, holy smokes, I might have used another word, but I'm sitting up here, I've got to do this on my own. You know, it's up to me. I've read a zillion Dharma books. I've gone to so many retreats. I go to Common Ground every Sunday night and every Tuesday night. I took the course on Satipatthana Sutta. But ultimately, oh my God, where am I at? It's up to me. And, it's about, so this talk is about that moment. And what do you do at that point? And what guidelines? What guidelines can you summon from then on to take what you've learned and make it real? So it's just not book learning. That's what the Buddha's last words were about. You know, there's the question from then on of how do you measure your progress, if measurement makes any sense, you know, in terms of spiritual growth, or your progress, if the word progress makes any sense. In a relative sense, both these words do matter, and how do you carry on from there? In my experience, at some point, you really need to do two things with all the book learning and all the retreats and all the lessons. And the two things are, number one, you need to essentialize. For example, that Anapanasati method has 16 steps to it. Well, that's a lot. And what's the logic behind those steps? You know, you really need to boil it down, because when you're sitting here or when you're out there and you're trying to make your way, you have to work from an essential, clear logic to you that works for you. Not what the book said would work, but what works for you. So you need to essentialize all these teachings so they're simple and they fit in your pocket and you can walk around with them and use them whenever you need. And so the second thing after essentializing is kind of related, but you need to customize to you, because not everything that is taught works for you. That's why in my guided meditation I was stressing whatever works for you in the way of posture to strike that zone between being relaxed and alert. Experiment with that, notice what works for you, and use those. So that's the process of customization. So I think you need to essentialize and you need to customize. And this too is something that the Buddha talked about in his last words, which I will read eventually, but I'm holding out for a little bit. I just want there to be a little dramatic tension in this talk. There are four different ways that I thought I might offer for this process of essentializing and customizing. They address, you know, the kind of natural barrier. I wanted to throw that in before I got to the first example. There are kind of natural barriers that make it difficult for us to essentialize and customize. And one I think I already mentioned was like the 16 steps. And those of you who've been reading and learning about the Dharma for a while, you know, there's the Eightfold Path, and there's the three characteristics, and there's the five hindrances, and there's the 10 fetters, and I could go on. I thought meditation was supposed to be simple. So there's a barrier right there, unless one adjusts thinking a little bit. Secondly, very much so in this tradition that we work in here, we're working through the Pali language, which was an ancient and now extinct Indian language, and then to English from Pali, and then from the English language to our own experience. So sometimes, for example, in the Anapanasati method, it says we're supposed to, as we breathe in and breathe out, we're supposed to look for piti. Well, what's piti? Oh, it's joy. That's how it's usually translated. But some people call it contentment, and some people call it rapture. So what is it? And how do we know that in ourselves, that we're experiencing joy when we breathe in and when we breathe out? What is piti, really? See? So there's this process that we need to go through to understand what the Buddha is really talking about. So it's translation back to our own felt and known experience, so we can start to be skillful with our own repertoire, our own experiential repertoire. So there's something we need to work through. And then finally, if you really look at it, the actual instructions for meditation given by the Buddha are pretty brief and sketchy. So the 16 steps in Anapanasati are about, they can be written out in two lines per step pretty much. So that's like 32 lines. And some people even boil it down to one line. So it's 16 lines. But like, for instance, there's the instruction to feel joy as you breathe in and joy as you breathe out. But the Buddha doesn't go on to say what joy is. He just says, breathe in knowing joy. And so there's some detective work to figure out what he meant. So so there are these issues that face each one of us as individual meditators in our spiritual lives. Okay, so now to the four examples that I'd like to offer for this process of essentialization and customization. And the first one I want to offer comes from, I'm just going to read a brief account of the Buddha's last day that's offered by Thich Nhat Hanh in his biography of the Buddha called Old Path, White Clouds. And I'm going to read it because I think there are really strong clues given by the Buddha and by the people who told the story of his last day about how to do this process of customizing for ourselves. So after 40 years of teaching the Dharma, the Buddha kind of wrapped it all up in his last day, in his last hours, in his last line. So I'd like to just read these few little stories that Thich Nhat Hanh wrote down to see if we might find out about how we can personalize and understand in this really essential way the Buddha's instructions about the path to the end of suffering. So here are a few little stories from the Buddha's last day by Thich Nhat Hanh. And it starts here, the last chapter. It was dusk by the time the Buddha and the bhikkhus reached the forest of sal trees, bhikkhus meaning monks. The Buddha asked Ananda to prepare a place between two sal trees for him to lie down. Ananda was his trusty servant and main attendant who followed him for about 30 years and critically was not an enlightened person during the Buddha's lifetime, whereas a lot of monks in the Buddha's retinue were getting enlightened right and left. Ananda, who was with the Buddha all the time and listened to all his sermons and memorized them, never got enlightened during the Buddha's lifetime. So the Buddha asked Ananda to prepare a place between two sal trees for him to lie down. The Buddha lay on his side, his head facing north. All the bhikkhus sat around him. They knew the Buddha would pass into nirvana that same night. The Buddha looked up at the trees and said, "Ananda, look, it is not yet spring, but the sal trees are covered with red blossoms. Do you see the petals falling on the Tathagata's robes and the robes of all the bhikkhus?" Tathagata is another word for the Buddha. "This forest is truly beautiful. Do you see the western horizon all aglow from the setting sun? Do you hear the gentle breeze rustling in the sal branches? The Tathagata finds all these things lovely and touching. Bhikkhus, if you want to please me, if you want to express your respect and gratitude to the Tathagata, there is only one way, and that is by living the teaching." The evening was warm, and the venerable Upavana stood over the Buddha to fan him, but the Buddha asked him not to. Perhaps the Buddha did not want his splendid view of the setting sun obstructed. The Buddha asked the venerable Anuruddha, "I do not see Ananda. Where is he?" Another bhikkhu spoke up, "I saw Brother Ananda standing behind some trees weeping. He was saying to himself, 'I have not yet attained my spiritual goal, and now my teacher is dying. Who has ever cared more deeply for me than my teacher?'" The Buddha asked the bhikkhu to summon Ananda. The Buddha tried to comfort Ananda. He said, "Don't be so sad, Ananda. The Tathagata has often reminded you that all dharmas are impermanent. With birth there is death, with arising there is dissolving, with coming together there is separation. How can there be birth without death? How can there be arising without dissolving? How can there be coming together without separation? Ananda, you have cared for me with all your heart for many years. You have devoted all your efforts to helping me, and I am most grateful to you. Your merit is great, Ananda, but you can even go farther. If you make just a little more effort, you can overcome birth and death. You can attain freedom and transcend every sorrow. I know you can do that, and that is what would make me the most happy." And then there's another big, thick paragraph where the Buddha goes on to praise Ananda in front of all the monks. He speaks about Ananda again at length, about what a devoted servant he is, how there could be no better servant than Ananda. And the next thing that happens is that an ascetic comes up to Ananda and asks him, because Ananda is the gateway to the Buddha, he says, "I would like to be ordained." And Ananda says, "No, the Buddha is busy now." You know, can't happen. But the Buddha sees or hears that this monk has company. He says, "No, Ananda, I'll receive this guy." And so there's a little story told here about taking this ascetic and ordaining him. And there's a little exchange between the Buddha and the ascetic that's quite interesting, I think. Because the ascetic says, he wants to ask the Buddha a question. this is before he gets ordained, but he wants to ask the Buddha a question. He says, Lord, I have heard about spiritual leaders such as Purana Kassapa, Makali Gosala, and several other ones. I would like to ask if, according to you, any of them attained true enlightenment. The Buddha answered, Subhata, whether or not they attend enlightenment is not a necessary thing to discuss right now. Subhata, the Tathagata, will show you the path by which you yourself can attain enlightenment. And then he goes on to explain the Eightfold Path. And then there's this famous section where three different times the Buddha asked the monks, Monks, I'm about to pass away. Do you have any questions at all about my teachings? And the first time he asks, silence. And the second time he asks, silence. And the third time he asks, silence. And then he says, okay, and here comes the big line. The Buddha looked quietly over the community and then said, Bhikkhus, listen to what the Tathagata now says. Dharmas are impermanent. If there is birth, there is death. Be diligent in your efforts to attain liberation. The Buddha closed his eyes. He had spoken his last words. The earth shook. Sal blossoms fell like rain. Everyone felt their minds and bodies tremble. They knew the Buddha had passed into nirvana. Does anybody have any ideas about why the first thing that happens in that story is the Buddha remarking on how beautiful the sunset is and how, you know, asking Ananda, do you see how the sal tree petals are falling on my robe? And just noticing the beautiful nature around him. That's the first thing that happens. That's traditionally the first thing that's recounted, is the Buddha just noticing the sky, the weather, nature. Well, anyway, it's worth reflecting on right there, isn't it? It's so simple. It's a simple, simple thing. So I'm just pointing that out. And to me, if I reflect on that, and I'll just offer my reflections, but I think, you know, the theme of this is really personalizing. So I'd really encourage you, having listened to that profound story, you might ask yourself, what is this story telling me about how I can practice? And, you know, how can I simplify and get to the point where, you know, I can really use these teachings and have them be a vital part of my life? Besides, when I drove up tonight, I was looking at the sky here and the ground here, and I was thinking about these teachings. And I was a little bit blissful, I have to say. I was feeling blissful, thinking about the sky as mind and the earth as body, and like as if I were looking at my own mind and noticing the impermanence of the clouds and the impermanence of my breath. That's just how I was looking at it. And it seemed like the teaching was coming through to me right there. I often think when I meditate that my breath is actually like the wind, and I'm just relating how I do it. I'm not saying it's for you at all. I'm just saying how I personalize it. I like to look at my breath as the wind, as if it were just passing through me. And sometimes my bodily sensations are a little bit like watching a crackling fire. And you know how you can watch a crackling fire and get a little bit mesmerized, but also just kind of get into a philosophical state of mind where you're calm and there's sort of nothing but you and nature. I think the Buddha was saying, reflect upon nature. It's important. It's important. A lot of lessons there. And I also personally really like, right, the fact that all throughout the afternoon, the stress was not on enlightenment. The stress was on Ananda and Subhata, the ascetic, who was trying to get ordained. And the Buddha actually saying that it's not important to ask questions about enlightenment. What's important is to personalize and figure it out for yourself. There was also a line in here where he says, Ananda said, Lord, please don't pass away here, because he was in this little town called Kusinara. Venerable Ananda wiped his tears and said, Lord, please don't pass away here. Kusinara is just a small town of mud dwellings. There are so many more worthy places like Sampa, Rajagaha, Savati, and Saketa, Kosambi, or Varanasi. Please, Lord, select such a place to pass away so that more people will have a chance to see your face one last time. And so he was, you know, worried about Kusinara being a small town of mud dwellings. And when I read that line, I see, Lord, please don't pass away here. Rochester is just a small town of mud dwellings. And the Buddha says, no. Kusinara is important. Rochester is important. Another way to essentialize the practice, I think, and these comments will, I think, maybe speak most to people who've taken that course on the Satipatthana Sutta or have read to the point or have experienced to the point where they've run across the categorization of human experience into what the Buddha calls the four foundations for mindfulness. So the Buddha basically teaches in several places that there are four places where it is wholesome and skillful to place your attention in meditation that lead to the calming of the mind and the arising of wisdom. And those are handy summary statements about what to do with the mind during meditation. And those places are the body and the breath, that's the one. The second is feelings, our pleasant and unpleasant sensations. The third is the mind, thoughts, opinions, views, whatever is going through the mind. And the fourth is called dharmas, which is explained in different ways, but a good way to think about it is to look at the first three from a different perspective, from the perspective of impermanence. So you look back at the body and the breath and notice the impermanence. And you look back at sensations, pleasant and unpleasant, and you notice their impermanence. And you look at the mind and its thoughts and you notice the impermanence. And then the Anapanasati method of mindfulness with breathing actually directs the attention through these 16 steps sequentially from body to feelings to mind to dharmas. And a way to kind of summarize that is that you go from just basically sitting down and relaxing, taking some deep breaths, getting centered. And the first 12 steps, which is three-fourths of the meditation, is really all about just getting centered and calm and relaxed. It's calming the body, calming the feelings, calming the mind. And then using the calm that we get to examine deeper. And, you know, that process, even though it's carved up into 16 steps, is actually something that can be shortened to by any of us at any time to just get calm, relax the body and the mind, and then look at impermanence in our experience, where, you know, in the body, the feelings, and the mind. You know, and that's essentially what we do. Whether we're doing 9 days of retreat or 9 minutes sitting in our back porch. There is a natural progression to meditation that it's important for us to feel intuitively. I'm going to read just a little bit from this book that Santikaro wrote called Mindfulness with Breathing, and it's the summation of his teaching of the meditation methods that really speaks to this point of how to customize those 16 steps. But it, again, it doesn't matter if it's 16 or 32 or whatever system you've learned. I mean, the essential teaching about customization and essentialization is right here. And where Buddhadasa Bhikkhu says, once you fully understand the entire 16 steps, or however many, you can abridge them for yourself. Decrease them until you are satisfied enough to practice with confidence. You might end up with 2 steps, or 5 steps, or whatever suits you. This is our purpose in the way we explain Anapanasati. We explain the system of practice in full, then you can shorten it for yourself, depending on what pleases you. Doesn't that sound good? That sounds pretty liberating to me. And here he actually telescopes the entire 16 steps into 2 steps here. He says, if some people feel that 16 steps are too much, that's all right. It is possible to condense the 16 steps down to 2 steps. 1, train the mind to be adequately and properly concentrated by calming it and focusing it, which is what we're doing in our guided meditation tonight. And 2, with that concentration, skip over to contemplating impermanence. He actually adds 2 others. 1 is suffering and not self. Those are the three things. But you know, you can even boil that down to impermanence. So I think those are helpful kind of shortenings down to the essence. Did anybody else have any thoughts about what lessons you might take from that story of the Buddha's last day? And how you would personalize it? Yeah.
Well, my initial thought would probably be similar to Sanna's, the essence of the teaching just being moment to moment of presence. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're alive, and when you're dead, you're dead. And he would never answer questions about death or the imponderable. It wasn't there yet. So I just see it as kind of a core teaching of presence, moment awareness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anybody else?
Face of death, cessation of his experience on this earth, he contacts something that's happening, has its own destiny, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
whatever the source, and that mm. is reassuring. The world will go on, mm-hmm. and I'm part of that, and so it's a,
oh,
it's a
yeah.
taking away from the loss into something that is reassuringly present.
Oh, yeah, right. That's beautiful. Thank you.
I just think it's so easy for me to live in my head. And that's always very informative, that's very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And so to not live in my head, but to be present with whatever's happening in that moment,
mm-hmm.
to me, that's the essence of a lot of my, what I would call progress.
Mm. And nature gets you out of your head. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like for others who are not enlightened,
mm-hmm.
head element.
Mm-hmm.
But for Buddha, I think when we are not attached, then we simply feel the pain. We can enjoy nature.
Were you saying that you can feel no attachment when you see nature sometimes? That you can actually experience that? that's kind of the ultimate, isn't it? Is that state of pleasure without attachment or unpleasantness without attachment. So you're saying just looking at nature is a good way to immediately experience that. Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. Yeah, great. Those are these are wonderful insights, I think. And every one of you has, I think, just gone straight to wisdom here, you know. Through that little simple story. So let's go a little deeper into those last words of the Buddha's. Thich Nhat Hanh, his rendition of them was a little different from the kind of mainstream Theravadan. He wrote, the way he rendered them is, dharmas are impermanent. If there is birth, there is death. Be diligent in your efforts to attain liberation. A little bit more of a mainstream Theravadan rendition of the Buddha's last words are, all conditioned things are subject to decay. Strive on diligently. You hear little variations here and there in the Theravadan, but that's basically the gist of it. All conditioned things are subject to decay. They are impermanent. Strive on diligently. Sometimes it's added for your own liberation. For those of you who are a little bit into Pali, the actual words are Vaya Dhamma Sankara Apamadina Sambateta. Sampadeta. Vaya Dhamma is, Dhammas are sort of, well, let's go back. Sankara as conditioned things. Vaya Dhamma. Dhammas are subject to decay. Apamadena is diligence, and Sampadeta is succeed. And the word I want to stress here that kind of, I think, releases a special insight is apamada, which is apamadena in the context of the sentence. And it's the word that is usually translated as diligently. And it's worth stressing, I think, because it's the one word in the sentence that actually tells us how to meditate, or what is the quality of mind that you want when you meditate. And, you know, it's a word that shows up from time to time in the original Buddhist texts. And it's interesting to do a little bit of linguistic etymology on that word to see what it really is, because it's the one quality that you want to bring to it. There are, in support of the idea of how important this particular quality of mind is, there are several places in the Buddhist suttas that speak to this. The Dhammapada is actually filled with references to apamada on how important it is. For example, one of the verses in the Dhammapada is heedfulness. That's how apamada is often translated. Heedfulness is the path to the deathless. Heedlessness, the path to death. The heedful do not die. The heedless are as if already dead. So that makes it a pretty important quality. And there's another of the early writings that talks about apamada this way. Just as all the footprints of living beings are surpassed by the footprint of the elephant, and the footprint of the elephant is considered as the mightiest among them, just so have all the meritorious qualities alertness as their foundation, and alertness is considered the mightiest of these qualities. Alertness being another way to translate apamada. Actually, if you really go to the Pali scholars who are looking at strict etymology as opposed to translating directly into language that works possibly better in a meditative setting, pamada, it means drunk. And is a negative prefix. So apamada is not drunk or sober. And so there's a strong sense here that the quality that one wants to bring to meditation is sobriety or clarity of mind, non-distractedness. And that one wants to bring this not just to the mind, but to all the senses. So the Buddha often talks about guarding the sense doors. The idea being that, in a sense, those of us who are distracted or unmindful are basically drunk six different ways. We're drunk with our eyes that are always seeking form for pleasure, and with our ears always seeking beautiful sounds to ravish our sensorium, and our fingers and our touch is always wanting to be intoxicated with a good feeling. And so on, with all the senses, including the mind, wanting to be intoxicated with all the things that intoxicate the mind, such as big, juicy, complex problems, you know, that can just sort of take us away through our endless attempts to solve the complexity and explain the complexity. So the quality that one wants to bring to meditation is the opposite of all that, a kind of settledness and a clarity that actually means that could be quite literally translated as sober or not drunk. So one could almost say, could almost translate the Buddha's last words as, all conditioned things are subject to decay. Strive on with a diligent sobriety. That might be a fair translation. And there's one other, I think, very helpful text that talks to what is appamatta, that appeals to many of us who like this particular path and who might be familiar with the so-called Kalama Sutta, where what's sometimes called the Buddha's Charter of Free Inquiry. So this is actually called, a similar sutta is called the Nandiya Sutta, where one of Buddha's monks came to him and said, Lord, would you please explain appamatta and what is this quality? And here's what the Buddha answered to the monk, Nandiya. The Blessed One said, and how, Nandiya, does a disciple of the noble ones live heedlessly? That would be appamatta, heedlessness. There is the case where a disciple of the noble ones is endowed with verified confidence in the awakened one. Indeed, the Blessed One is worthy and rightly self-awakened, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well gone, an expert with regard to the world, unexcelled as a trainer for those people fit to be tamed, the teacher of divine and human beings, awakened, blessed. Content with that verified confidence in the awakened one, he does not exert himself further in solitude by day or seclusion by night. Right? So he's content that the Blessed One has all the answers and he's following him. For him, living thus heedlessly, there is no joy. There being no joy, there is no rapture. There being no rapture, there is no serenity. There being no serenity, he dwells in pain. When pained, the mind does not become centered. When the mind is uncentered, phenomena do not become manifest. When phenomena are not manifest, he is reckoned simply as one who dwells heedlessly. Appamatta. So that leaves the question of the person who has appamatta, and what is that? And to that, the Buddha answers, And how, Nandiya, does a disciple of the noble ones live heedfully? There is the case where a disciple of the noble ones is endowed with verified confidence in the awakened one, not content with that verified confidence in the awakened one. Okay, not content with that verified confidence in the awakened one. He exerts himself further in solitude by day or seclusion by night. For him, living thus heedfully, joy arises. In one who has joy, rapture arises. In one who has rapture, the body becomes serene. When the body is serene, one feels pleasure. Feeling pleasure, the mind becomes centered. When the mind is centered, phenomena become manifest. When phenomena are manifest, he is reckoned as one who dwells heedfully. So there we have another quality of appamatta. It's that quality that one summons when one gets to the point where the teacher is, you know, one reaches that point that I talked about right at the beginning of, you know what, the teacher's not going to take me all the way. That's, And then what do? That's when apamata comes in. It's got courage. It's got kind of skillful desire. It's ardent, a word often used. And it is just so strengthened by a want to be free that just pushes one on. And that's what the Buddha is saying here. That, in his very last words, he says, strive on diligently. And on the one hand, that sounds almost like cliche. It's like, okay, carry on, try hard. Then you look a little deeper, you look at the etymology, you look at what it means to some of the commentators, and I think it yields a sense of the Buddha's last words that are useful to us who ask ourselves the questions, what do we do when the teachings sometimes seem dry or just come to a point where we realize we've got to bring in our own resources to carry on and go all the way. So those are some thoughts on the Buddha's last words. And we have some time for Q&A or discussion, if you would like, or any reflections on the Buddha's last words, on the Buddha's last day. Yeah?
I was kind of taken by this idea that bhikkhus had something to ask. Three times the bhikkhus are asked, do you have a question? They just remain silent.
Yeah.
But then it also went on to say that they all reached enlightenment that the desire. So then the Buddha asked the children, strive on diligently.
Mm-hmm.
They're already there sometimes. So I don't know what the practice is, but that the light ones that they continue to strive.
Well, I'm not enough of a scholar to know if they did all reach enlightenment on that evening. I'm not sure they did. Did you hear that in what Thich Nhat Hanh said?
I thought that's what Thich Nhat Hanh said, that all the bhikkhus did.
Not sure about that. I'll read. Yeah, he said, here's what, because on each occasion, there was actually a reason why the Buddha kind of interpolated why there was silence. So I'll read you what he interpolated there as to why there was silence. So the first time he asked them about this was, bhikkhus, if you have any doubts or perplexity concerning the teaching, now is the time to ask the Tathagata about it. Don't let this opportunity pass by, so that later you will reproach yourself saying, that day I was face to face with the Buddha, but I did not ask him. The Buddha repeated these words three times, but no bhikkhu spoke. Venerable Ananda exclaimed, Lord, it is truly wonderful. I have faith in the community of bhikkhus. I have faith in the Sangha. Everyone has clearly understood your teaching. No one has any doubts or perplexity about your teaching and the path to realize it. The Buddha said, Ananda, you speak from faith while the Tathagata has direct knowledge. The Tathagata knows that all the bhikkhus here possess deep faith in the three gems, the Buddha, the Sangha, and the Dhamma. Even the lowest attainment among these bhikkhus is that of stream enterer. So that's I don't think I actually read that the first time, but that's saying that they're on the path to enlightenment but haven't been enlightened. Stream entry is like, okay, I think the technical thing is you're only going to return to life seven times, something like that, or three or something. That's stream entry. So they're not actually enlightened, but they're well on the way. And as I read this now, I see that Thich Nhat Hanh has actually telescoped those three different times, into one. And he has Ananda saying that the reason why people, why the monks haven't asked questions is the faith in the community of bhikkhus. I have faith in the Sangha. everyone has clearly understood your teaching. No one has any doubts or perplexity and the path to realize it. And the Buddha said, Ananda, you speak from faith, while the Tathagata has direct knowledge. Yeah. As I read this in relation to the Nandiya Sutta, I think that the Buddha is also saying, you know, faith, yes, but keep trying. You have to go more than faith. You can't just have faith in me. You have to try. And I think that's the key thing in with the word apamada, striving diligently, is go beyond the faith, just the simple, blind faith, so to speak. Yeah.
So you did read farther on where the Buddha passes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I thought
that yeah, let's go. Oh, I see what you're saying. Here's what Thich Nhat Hanh says, and this is a, you know, an interpretation. But he writes, the Buddha closed his eyes. He had spoken his last words. The earth shook. Sal blossoms fell like rain. Everyone felt their minds and bodies tremble. They knew the Buddha had passed into nirvana. That's it. That's it. Yeah. Does anybody know? Has anyone? And from a scholarly understanding? Or?
My understanding is that most of the community is quite sad. Ananda did achieve enlightenment, but it was a while later. I don't know about the other monks. But mm-hmm. the sadness would kind of, I mean, at least to me, imply that they weren't enlightened. But I certainly don't know.
Yeah.
I think they were
really
negative, and some of them were not enlightened.
Yeah, I think so. And as I read it over, I think the Buddha is saying there that everyone here is a stream enterer, which in this sequence, which in this system is, like I said, it's sort of like training wheels. They're on their way, but they're not there yet. And you're right, Ananda wasn't enlightened until after the Buddha's death. Yeah.
To me, the whole term enlightenment is such an incongruity.
Mm.
You can't really grasp what that means. And mm-hmm. who is the one who is applying the seal of enlightenment?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does that help? You know, and so the question in mind may be helpful so not to become too complacent. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just say, oh, well, I am the God. Well, that's because I see sometimes the metaphor of, you know, some of those like gurus and so on who end up succumbing to mm-hmm. corruption and abuse.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point to raise. And that actually draws attention to the earlier passage in this very story where the Buddha said in his last hour, it's not important to ask about whether so-and-so is enlightened. You know, that's what he told the ascetic who was seeking ordination. And he asked that specific question. Oh, this monk who says he's enlightened, is he really? And that monk, is he really? And the Buddha said, not important. Yeah. Does anyone have any examples or ways that they themselves have kind of essentialized or kind of customized their practice that they would be willing to share? That have sort of opened the practice in a real living, direct way for you? Yeah.
I think it's a process of centralizing. On the last month, I think one of the talks been focused on equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just struggle with that word.
Mm.
I mean, and I keep being finding this, what's this equanimity? What's this equanimity? I mean, it's become like a mantra.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, you know, you look it up and you know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have not thought of my word that's going to open that door.
Oh, right.
And, you know, so I'm in the process of trying to
Right.
Right,
right, right.
You know, and a lot of times in different talks, you know, there'll be some kind of key.
Right.
Trigger a word in me that I can take away and, you know, that I made it mine.
Yeah, yeah. Like what word have you made yours?
Gratitude.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That word works for you.
Yes,
yeah.
It does. Yeah. It really does. It slices through the juicy stories that my mind wants to.
Right, 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 right. Well, let me ask you this. So when you say the word gratitude, what do you feel?
Well, I feel a physical sensation through just a moment of love.
So there are a couple of steps in the 16-step method where the Buddha actually says to trigger that bubbling process. You know, I mean that's actually a part of the that process of calming the mind and centering the mind and also clarifying so one can really see what's going on in the mind and body. So it's wonderful that you have that word that triggers that, as you say, the bodily physical sensation, and that is so important. It is so important, you know. And what's the other one?
That's the other word. Remember.
Remember, yeah, yeah, to bring you back. And so you're still looking for equanimity. You're looking for. Do you have a felt sense of what it means as opposed to the word that attaches to that feeling?
But
have a felt sense of what you described gratitude as being bubbling up.
Yes, and that's what I've not felt.
So you haven't developed a sense of like when I feel equanimity, my body feels this way, or I feel this happening. So you're really searching for that experience, not just the word, but to know that within yourself, what equanimity feels like. That's what you're searching for, right? Yeah. That's an important point there, that we're not really searching for words. You know, we're just like, and all the things we felt, where is equanimity in there? Yeah. That'll be a beautiful moment when you realize.
I found it interesting that, I'm not sure I could repeat this well, but mm-hmm. you mentioned in that comment that joy mm-hmm. was something that happened on the way to something else. In everyday life, we sometimes think of joy as the goal,
mm-hmm.
but here it's in passing and
yes.
in the process.
That's correct. And again, in the Anapanasati method, the joy is you know, it's posited as a feeling that energizes you, sort of early in the process. It's actually the fourth step. Once you've calmed your mind and body just by watching your breath and your body, the instruction is to try to find that sense of joy, which could be the bubbling up, you know, and to use the breath to suffuse that through. And then following that is a sense of not an energetic joy, which is that first sense of like when you breathe in sometimes, can you feel it? Like there's a kind of a energetic filling. That's joy. And then on the out-breath, it's more of a relaxed contentedness. And these are stages that one feels, that one is directed to draw one's attention to, that's part of this natural process of calming the mind and the body. And it's also what the Buddha is talking about during that passage that I read about rapture leading to serenity leading to, let's see here, joy leading to rapture, leading to serenity, leading to pleasure, leading to a centered mind, leading to phenomena becoming manifest. So, you know, these words all sound the same in the English language, or very close to the same. Joy, contentment, rapture, right? But the teachings are saying to direct our attention inward, to see if we can discriminate more carefully about what's really in us. In felt sensation, especially on the positive side, that these are actually feelings that arise as the mind becomes calmer and becomes more centered. So you're absolutely right. Joy is just, it's an early kind of energetic, pleasant feeling, but it calms down and it leads to a calmer and calmer mind. So why don't we just end by sitting for a couple of minutes, letting the words go. So tonight we've reflected on the Buddha's last teachings, in which he explained that after he was gone, those who wanted to know him could go to the teachings, that he would exist in the form of the teachings. That these teachings could be a centering, guiding refuge. Through these practices, we might access the calm, peaceful qualities in our hearts to make ourselves more calm and peaceful, and to be the cause and condition for widening calm and peace amongst those we know, and rippling out beyond to those we don't, to beings known and unknown. May all beings experience calm. May all beings be without suffering. Thanks for coming, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.